Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for 11-11-2021, November 11th. So lots of ones in the date today. What does that mean? Nothing. So anyway, a lot of topics to cover tonight, and I will be continuing my long-term discussion here regarding electric highways to the stars. And I'm getting more into the personal part of this. I started out many, many weeks ago dealing with hardware and electrical currents in the solar system and the galaxy, how to, you know, the overall effects, and how I came up with these concepts back in the days when nobody had any concept of how you really actually should be moving amongst the stars, which brings up a good point today. Or was it yesterday, within the last 24 hours, I believe, SpaceX delivered the first three astronauts to the space station, the International Space Station, which is an international effort for Russia and probably the European Space Agency a little bit in the United States to have some presence in outer space. And, of course, it's been there for a while. What was it like? How many decades ago? It was 1966. So let me count that. 76, 86, 96, 2006, 2016. We're a good 55 years ago. NASA was launching Gemini, the two space capsules where they learned how to dock. That was one of the big issues with doing a space program and going to the moon, part of the Apollo program, 1966. And, of course, in 1969, the alleged Apollo moon landing occurred. One of the key things they needed was to be able to dock spacecraft in outer space. The Russians had already learned how to do this by 66. They were well on their way to manned spaceflight, etc. That's what the Gemini meaning twins, in other words, two spacecraft, and they learned how to dock and do all the maneuvering and then crawl from one spacecraft into the other. That preceded the Apollo program, which was the actual moon program. It was actually an extremely well-designed program. It's just when it came down to the final count, there was a few problems, as you might expect with a lot of engineering efforts. But anyway, I digress. But that was my point is that we're still at about the same technological level as 1966. Chemical rockets going in space, taking three guys there. Woo, big headline. But really not. I mean, it's really pathetic. It's pathetic that really we have not progressed in 55 years in so-called the most advanced country in the world. Well, I think, anyway, you know, and the whole reason for me talking about electric highways to the stars is to show you that, and this is, by the way, all a facade. The chemical space rockets and all of that is just a big facade. There was a company, it's called Spin Launch, and they just had a test within the last couple days. They're out in New Mexico. And their idea is to accelerate a spacecraft within a high acceleration, like a rock on the end of a string, but accelerate this thing up to extreme high, eventually up to Mach 5, if you can imagine that. And then it comes out of this tube and then goes into space. And the idea is that you save on rocket fuel. But I think what's going to happen is that their initial test was way below the velocity, and they said they went up to 10,000 feet. Well, that's about two miles. They actually said tens of thousands of feet in the article that I saw on this. So, you know, a number of miles. And this is a little rocket. Once again, it's about 3 meters long, so about 10 feet long. And I'm gonna say something very positive about this. I'm impressed. I've known about Spin Launch for a long time. They had some issues trying to find a place to be, and they finally were able to get a location at the Spaceport America that's in New Mexico, It's the state-run spaceport in the state of New Mexico, and that's where Richard Branson has his. That's where they launched their recent first of taking civilians into space on a privately owned spacecraft, etc. And of course, this is before when they did the space, the Ansari XPRIZE over 10 years ago. I think it was like in 2010 or so. They were out at Burt Rutan's location out in the Mojave Desert. But anyway, back to spin launch. So they spin this rocket in like on the end of a rod, and it's balanced, of course, and they spin it up to a very high rotational velocity, and then it comes shooting out this tower, and the whole idea is to reduce the amount of fuel that a rocket has to take. So when you get up to the point where it's no longer kinetic energy, in other words, it's lost its kinetic energy due to gravitation, but primarily due to the oxygen due to the atmosphere, then you have an issue that you got to get all the way up into orbit with fuel. So the fuel becomes part of the payload. But here's the real issue. They said they were running at around 20%. Okay, so that would give you a feel for what kind of rotational velocity they're having here. But the equation for centrifugal force is mv squared over r. So the higher, the bigger the radius, you get more centrifugal force. But here's the crux. Given their machine that they built, their accelerator disk, it's the V squared term. So if they were going at 20%, that means full capacity would be five times that. So that means the centrifugal force would be 25 times that. So we're talking some serious, serious G-forces here. And so we're talking about potentially thousands and thousands of G's. In other words, G meaning the force of gravity. And that's kind of a tool we use in science, in physics, to get an estimate. For example, a jet fighter pilot might undergo 2 G's in a pullout when he's diving and then pulling out, or doing a hard turn or something like that. In ace fighter pilot would experience up to 2, maybe up to 3, around 3 G's, a person's going to lose it, around 3. So in spin launch, we're talking thousands, potentially tens of thousands of G's of force. And so the only thing imaginable that could manage this would be something like a solid lead ball. And I don't know the value in putting a solid lead ball into space. It's not going to be able to work for any manned flights. The idea is to get microsatellites into space, and I commend their effort. Now, on the flip side, I'm very impressed. They've got a long list of supporters here. They've got, I'm not going to read them off on the air, but they have some, they've raised about $110 million. That's impressive. So they got some big hitters out there. And so they've got a well-organized machine in terms of the finances, etc. And when you look at their video and the people doing this, they're all young people. So I'm very impressed. But of course, the main customer here is the military. And so an accelerator gun is what they're looking at, some kind of space cannon. I can just see the use of this in space as a satellite destroyer, because once you get this thing out of the atmosphere, you're dealing with a whole different issue, that you don't have the atmosphere anymore to block the air resistance. And that's the biggest problem with any launch, is getting above that lowest part of the atmosphere. And I have a system myself designed, it's the Hotel Space Launch System. And the whole idea there is to, whatever your concept is, to get above that thick part of the atmosphere to reduce the amount of fuel needed. And of course, I applaud these people for they're going to have a product, and it's going to be viable. But I think their main customer is going to be the military, and that for me is like space. let's get the military out of space. And that ain't going to happen. Once the military gets there, it's like the Roman army. You know, they're going to be there. And then they're going to bring their wars and everything else with them. And by the way, I have written about this whole topic in my book, like The Diamond Principle. And every book I've ever written has a chapter, and it's called Will Man Survive? And here's the issue. So in one hand, I applaud the successes and everything of Spin Launch and other companies, etc. But here's the problem. As we go out into outer space, and one can only imagine that there are out there somewhere galactic federations that have gotten together. And one of the things they're going to look at, if there's a progressing civilization that's becoming spacefaring, etc., is the following. Are they bringing their like Earth-like petty wars into outer space with them? Because the last thing you need out there is a warring tribe. So imagine that we were here on Earth. Let's take the two-dimensional model back on planet Earth. Let's take the imagine there's a country that's emerging somewhere. And all of a sudden, they start tremendous military buildup and an expansion. Let's put it that way. So right now, we're very concerned about Japan, because in World War II, they were told they could never have a military again because of attacking Pearl Harbor and all that. Well, they got one heck of a military going right now. How about China? China is famous for attacking its neighbors. They attacked Japan before World War II. They were expanding. China was attacking all of its neighbors on the mainland there. They were expanding, so they were considered an international threat. And, of course, that's going on now. If you look at any little country, like, say, that's the excuse they had for going into Libya, that, oh, they were expanding. And or the threat of Al-Qaeda, which, of course, is a CIA-supported militant group in the Mideast, or the Taliban, or any of those. They're all CIA-initiated, started. During the Obama administration, they were funded, basically. So anyway, while I applaud Spin Launch for what they're doing and their successes, also, I just see it as a military weaponization of this technology and not really benefiting mankind as such. So anyway, I wanted to put that in there because I'm in the process of talking about electric highways to the stars, the real way we should be getting into outer space. And of course, when I was in 1982, long before probably most of these people were even born, I was in Los Angeles marketing my electric propulsion systems, which of course at the time nobody even dreamed about because they didn't understand the electrical nature of our atmosphere and the outside of our atmosphere and the solar system and the et cetera and the galaxy. So here I am in Los Angeles marketing my technologies, etc. And it gets stolen by the military and taken and militarized against my wishes. And that's why I was basically squeezed out of my own project, because I told them, I said, I don't want this being used for military purposes, delivering nuclear bombs, etc. And so and here I am talking to the venture capital groups who make their money selling to the military and moving military hardware around the planet. Anyway, and of course, this is where I first saw the what some people call the New World Order, the bankers, the Illuminati, the families that operate the world and who have tremendous wealth, and their wealth is something that feeds them. Remember the guy that, this happened many years ago, there was a submarine, and some guy finagled, he was a big investor, a big family member, let's put it this way, and he conned some nuclear submarine captain, or higher up, this was not the nuclear submarine captain that allowed this, but he allowed this guy on the ship, of course, per direct orders above him. To run the submarine, and what he wanted to do was a breach, kind of like the whales do. You know, they come flying up out of the water and then come slamming down. Well, this guy wanted to do a breach, and of course, being a big family member, let's just put it that way, he got his wish. So when he's coming up to do the breach, they hit a Japanese research boat out in the middle of the ocean. I mean, can you imagine this captain being so stupid that that he didn't know that there was a fishing, there was not a fishing boat, it was a, it had a lot of students on it. It was a Japanese research, sea research vessel. So this submarine comes up and slams it and kills all these people. So they court-martial the captain of the submarine. He gets the blame, but of course, some, and I'm sure the top, this was all verbal communication. So whoever orchestrated this thing, probably goes all the way up to the president, never got any blame. Because it's not like you could sequester a nuclear submarine, get in it and drive it, I mean, unless there was some pre-approval from higher up somewhere. This is not just the captain, hey, buddy, come on over and you want to drive my submarine for a while. No, this had high-level approval, and of course it went wrong. So anyway, what I'm saying is when I was in Los Angeles, I met these people through the venture capital groups, and I saw what they were doing, and I when I first saw this, these young guys, well-dressed, super nice cars, Lamborghinis, and, you know, hot chicks and beautiful wives and living in, you know, the most exclusive areas up in the hills or, you know, out of L.A. or down by San Diego, and moving millions of dollars a day, calling up congressmen. I saw this. I saw them pick up the phone, call a congressman and say, hey, I heard that this bill isn't going through. I want so many millions of dollars in this company by tomorrow. And it would happen. I'm going, God, how do you get a job like this? Where did these guys go to college? You know, I mean, how do you, you know, and at that point I was thinking job, you know, getting a job to do this. No, these were the kids of the families being primed to grow up into this lifestyle of managing the money that came out of the European banks. And these were international families. They were Irish. They were from the Arab countries. They were from all the countries of the world. And so this, and then I sat down and being a mathematician, I made some estimates. I made some estimates of how many people in the world were actually running the world from this financial level, you know, managing companies, et cetera. Because when it comes right back to it, all of these companies are owned by the same few people up on the very top. You know, you think of, oh, General Electric or Siemens or, you know, whatever the company is. And you think these are big international companies with presidents and CEOs. But ultimately, these babies are owned by these few families. And I estimated that there are 5,000 people in these families operating and managing the world. So you're in the top of the CIA, and then you have your pecking order too. So you have, say, for example, George Bush Sr., who ran the CIA for many years. Well, he was the son of a banker, the Schiff family, and they came to the United States really during World War II to manage the banking setup in the United States, because the United States was already banker-owned and operated since the, well, since the War of 1812, literally, if you go back. But it certainly was solidified in 1913, in 1911, 1905, all of those edicts of Congress, which established the Federal Reserve and the et cetera. And then you have the Morgans, who had the federal, you know, everything was federal or reserve, I'm sorry. For example, you had reserve mining, where they came in and bought out these investors who were in working in the Mesabi brothers, who owned this big mine up in central northern Minnesota, which is now the called Mesabi Range after them. But let me just give you this little piece of history. The Mesabi brothers, and I believe they were from Europe someplace, they came over and they discovered, they knew how to search for iron ore, which they knew would be the great future commodity, and they discovered the biggest vein of iron ore on the planet in Mesabi Range in Minnesota. And so anyway, they were developing this. They brought in, I believe, Chinese workers to build the railway and to start the initial mining, etc. But they needed to get the ore to Lake Superior. And so they had to build a railway. And they were running out of funds, so they go to J.P. Morgan, the same guy that screwed over Tesla. This guy has a long history of taking people to the cleaners, big-time people. So the Mesabi brothers are running out of money, so they go to J.P. Morgan to finish funding the railway to Lake Superior. And so, of course, the old standard investment technique is you give them some money and you say, well, when you produce, we'll give you some more. Well, that's a ticket to disaster. And I've had that offered to me. Jim, we'll give you this amount of money for your project. And when we see some results, then we'll give you some more. That's the formula that they take over your company. And I've never bitten on that. I did once. And they tried to take my company over. It was an archery company. And I had developed the first carbon bows, carbon fiber bows, product line. And they invested $15,000. This is way back in the early 90s. In my company. And so they, at that point, they pulled that. They said, okay, we'll invest this much, and when we see you producing bows and having sales, we'll give you the other $15,000. Well, of course, I needed the other $15,000 to move forward and expand the business. And then they held out and they said, look, we'll buy your company from you for pennies on the dollar. And I closed the whole thing down. And But anyway, that's the technique. So they did that to the Mesabi brothers. And the Mesabi brothers, of course, went bankrupt. They went out of business. And J.P. Morgan came in and funded that. This is back in the early 1900s, like 1905, something like that. The same time they're setting up the Federal Reserve, etc. And J.P. Morgan called it reserve mining. And so it's ever since then, it was called reserve mining. And, of course, then they brought in the labor forces. I had an uncle that worked up there. And he was an engineer. His job was to keep the machinery running. Uncle Ben was his name. Since passed, I would not mention his name on the air if he were still living. But a big Polish guy, I think he was Polish, big guy, and knew how to fix those big machines that were immense, giant machines that were digging this big open pit mine up on the Mesabi Range. But anyway, they brought in, of course, thousands of workers, built entire towns around there where the people lived and worked, etc. And, of course, the jobs, the money brought people in. They could have a nice house. They could work at the mines and relatively safe work. You know, I'm sure people got hurt, but a relatively safe work was an open pit mine. But J.P. Morgan came in, bought it out, screwed over the Mesabi brothers, took it, put his name on it, and it's so interesting that the Federal Reserve, reserve mining, and there were many other things in that time that they called reserve. And this was the European bankers. Morgan was the hand, one of the handles, the Chase, Morgan, all of those. I could, you know, go through the laundry list of names of bankers that are still there today. So all of the banks in the United States are sub-banks of these few major big banks. And so that's why when they had the housing crisis a number of years ago, the massive amount of wealth that was transferred went from you, the public, to these bankers. They claimed that five families took all the property in the United States then in the foreclosures. Then they turned over, and of course, they created the problem. The problem was created during the Bush administration, the George Bush Jr. administration. It was set up to where they would open up the loans to anybody. Anybody could sign for a loan. Anybody that didn't even have $10. And so these people would buy houses. They could go in and get approved for a loan. And so they deregulated the loans, etc. And I knew people who were writing 10 or 20 loans per day, and they would make about $1,000 per loan, writing the loan. And they were just like ecstatic because they were making a lot of money, the loan writers, and they were making, you know, $10,000, $12,000 a day writing loans. So everybody was happy until the thing crashed, because these people that they wrote loans to couldn't make the payments. There's no way. It's the same thing they do to foreign countries, little third world foreign countries. They come in, give them a big loan, and the leaders are happy as heck to sign off on that loan. It just happened during COVID. The U.S. signed off on trillions of dollars of loans from the banks, and now the Democrats are spending it like a bunch of drunk sailors on infrastructure, which is going to go into just a few people's pockets, most of it. But anyway, making the United States a third world country, beholding to the bankers forever, So anyway, that's, and by the way, that's what one of the things that Trump was trying to resist, and that the Democrats just took it in hook, line, and sinker with these massive, massive infrastructure programs, trillions and trillions of dollars. And it'll simply, it's not going to go to you, the public. It's going to go into the pockets of these ultra wealthy people. Okay, so anyway, I'm kind of diverging here, but I'm not, because coming back to the space program and the fact that yesterday SpaceX launched three guys up to the space station. What I'm talking about is banker controlled world. And now, the space program, the entire space program is centered around this concept that we're going to have a few people go to Mars in 5-10 years, and they'll put the date out. NASA just extended the date. Well, they don't even have a rocket. They don't have a spaceship. They don't have anything. They've never sent a test vehicle to Mars. I mean, going to Mars is like, yeah, I'm going to go to Mars. Hey, I'm going to go to Mars, everybody. Let's everybody give me about $40 billion. And I mean, NASA can no more go to the moon or to Mars than the man in the moon. It's just absolutely ludicrous. And scientific organizations, not just me talking, scientific organizations have met nationally and determined that NASA does not have the ability to go to the moon again, let alone Mars, which is a whole different ballgame. Okay, so anyway, the whole point is that NASA is a smokescreen. The whole thing is a smokescreen, and anything useful that comes out, like Spin Launch, will be, and for all these guys working, I hope some of them are listening, and then if you're listening, direct your directors or the heads of your company. And I applaud what you're doing. I'm impressed. I'm very impressed with Spin Launch, but it's going to become a military vehicle. That's it. So you guys are thinking going into space and the future of space and private space, etc. No, you're going to be a military-owned product, and your owners are going to get bought out. They're going to buy a nice house in Hawaii someplace and then disappear out of the woodwork, and it's going to become a military machine, and it's going to. That's it. So that's what you're doing. You're developing military hardware that's going to be used to take war into space. Congratulations. I hope you enjoy your money. Okay, and I don't do that. I don't play that game. Long time ago, I learned it, and I have standards. I don't bow to the military. I don't develop things for them. In fact, I have space technology that has not been released. It's with me and with me only. And it's going to stay that way. I'm not going to give some, because the very first thing that happens, the absolute very first thing that happens with any technology, is that it's considered by the military, and they have the right to come in and hide patents and take over patents and whatever it takes. And so writing a patent for your design is like, you may as well just give it to the military. Because they'll come in and take it, and they'll develop it, and you'll never even know that they're developing it. In fact, I would hedge to say that Spin Launch's technology is already well being developed other places where they're not aware of it, and they're going to someday have their funding just kind of dry up, and never really know what's going on, and all of a sudden their technology will be developed. It's already being developed somewhere else, I guarantee you. And their company will dry up and go away and become a puff of smoke in the history of the annals of space travel. But their technology will live on, and they won't even know it. That's what's going to happen. Okay, so anyway, this is the banker world you live in. In the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church, which, by the way, is the head of the World Bank, the Jesuits, the Rothschild banking system, is the Vatican Bank, which became wealthy in the Middle Ages when the Spanish and the English and the Portuguese and Italians and everybody else, the Northern Europeans, came into the New World, raped and pillaged everything. All of that wealth came back to the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church had its fingers out all over Europe. And so all of that wealth, that's where the Rothschild banking system really got its hold, because that's where this vast amount of wealth came in. In fact, the gold in Fort Knox ain't in Fort Knox anymore. It's in the Vatican, and so or some holding location for the Vatican, but in the Vatican banks, and that's where they get their wealth. And that's why the Queen of England has power. She doesn't have power. She gets her power from the Bank of England. She's a Rothschild. She's German. She ain't English. The English people know this. The Queen of England is a German, born in Germany. I mean, people, yeah, if you don't know what's going on in the world, it's better time to, as my Uncle Ben used to say, open up your big brown eyes and see what's going on around you in the world today. Okay, well, I'm kind of getting off my point this week, and so I'm going to try and get back on a few other topics here. But also, just a quick comment. I saw this on space.com, where scientists have discovered that the land formations on Earth are millions of years older than previously thought. And I'm looking at this, and I'm going, oh, my goodness. Look, nobody knows the age of the Earth, I guarantee you. And the Earth has been here probably much longer than 4.5 billion years. It's probably a very old planet. It's lost its atmosphere multiple times. It's had major catastrophes multiple times, just like Mars. And this brings up a point that I want to talk about here. There's questions about whether there's life in the universe, etc. And would there be another water planet, or could there be? And I just saw some guy make a statement that maybe the Earth is really unique and it's the only one out there, you know, and there's really, maybe we're the only creatures in the universe. It's so unlikely. And the point is that we used to have two water planets in the solar system. One of them was Mars, and it was only a few thousand years ago that it lost its atmosphere when the whole Quetzalcoatl event happened. I will use that term to quote the Mayans, who saw it happen. Mars was a blue water planet. It lost its ocean and atmosphere, and you can see all the remnants today. I have on my Picture of the Day subpage a tremendous amount of, in the middle of my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, I have 8 pages which have high-resolution prints of the entire surface of Mars, and I point out all the places. I mean, it's very clear that Mars had oceans and rivers and erosion only a few thousand years ago, because it has all of these dust storms, and all of that surface features, geological surface features of Mars would be gone because of these tremendously powerful dust storms that constantly are going on the planet Mars. But to reinforce my point, we had two water planets in this solar system when we only have got, well, let me say exactly how many planets we have, including Pluto. Of the original 9 planets, Jupiter and Saturn are not planets. They are small stars. Let's get that straight. So, okay, 9 minus 2 equals 7. So we have 7 somewhat terrestrial kind of planets, Neptune and Uranus included. Okay, now Pluto is a planet, and so of the 7 real planets in our solar system, of the ones that are, you know, and there's hundreds and hundreds more out there that are way out there in what they call the Kuiper Belt, beyond Pluto. But of the 7 terrestrial types of planets in the solar system, 2 out of 7, that's pretty good odds. That's like, if 2 out of 8, that would be 25%. So more than 25%, 2/7, whatever, would be, let's say 30% would be water planets. Well, that's pretty high percentage. And the reason for that is because once an object is in orbit, once it's been captured, it's solidified its orbit, it's the tail drag has brought it into a stable orbit, most solar systems will have the same arrangement of gases. And in this zone, we have oxygen and nitrogen and a lot of hydrogen, boatloads of hydrogen, and sodium and all of the other components, calcium, all the other components that you find in planet Earth, iron, etc. Is when the planet got closer to the sun, there was a vast amount of iron and like just a good impact from something would also put that amount of iron in a single location, which is probably what happened up in the Mesabi Range, a surface hit by a large asteroid that was high iron content. Okay. And you find these all over. For example, the Nazca Plains, you find high iron content, little rocks all over, completely strewn with them, and that's what they move aside to create the Nazca lines, but I digress again. But anyway, 2 out of 7 planets were water planets. What the heck? That's pretty good odds. So if you consider that maybe that's a little high, there's 1 out of 10 planets is a water planet. Hey, they're all over the place. There's zillions of these things. There's water planets is common. They're every place you're going to look. And for example, if you looked in other star systems with the technology we have today, you're not going to see Earth-sized planets. We're not at the technology, and you might be able to see one in a nearby star. Somebody might correct me. Oh, no, we can see it on the very next star. Well, no, I'm talking about out in the major galaxy. You're not going to be detecting Earth-sized water planets in the majority of the galaxy. So given this proportion, given this statistic of about 20% or even 10%, that's a lot of water planets. And as I talked about once before on the show, talking about the Colburn talks specifically about transiting the Great Void, meaning that some portion of our population came to planet Earth across a large void of outer space, meaning intergalactic, from another star. And that could mean that they came from Mars. That would be a great void also. But anyway, my point is that there is probably abundant, more than abundant, water planets out there. And of course, if you have water, you can have atmosphere of oxygen and hydrogen and nitrogen. And, you know, you're going to have very similar conditions as you have on planet Earth. And if it has a moon, then you're going to have a magnetic field, and you're going to have a protective magnetic field which protects from the solar radiation, from the radiation coming off the local star. So anyway, I would say that out in the galaxy, there are abundant. In fact, look at, we have 3 of the 4 moons of Jupiter would be water planets if they were independent and in closer to Earth. So that makes 3 more. And then there's one of the major moons of Saturn is also in ice, would be a water planet if it were closer to the sun. And so here we got 4, and these are big. These are big moons. These are not little teeny ones. These are big moons that have high water ice content on their surfaces, water ice. And so, and if you brought Pluto in closer to our region of the solar system, it would have, instead of taking up the nitrogen-hydrogen compounds that it's taking up out there by discharging the solar capacitor, it would be happening in the inner solar system. It would be picking up oxygen and hydrogen, making water, etc. Pluto would be a water planet. So any object that gets into our region of the solar system, Mars is accumulating atmosphere all the time. It's becoming a water planet again. It'll take millions of years to accumulate enough atmosphere where it's got a serious amount of water. But it was a water planet only a number of thousands of years ago. Okay, so anyway, it gives you an impetus for space travel. But I'll tell you something, we're being very poor stewards of this planet. This planet is seriously polluted, and the most advanced countries, Europe, the United States, are seriously polluted. I live in the world of water. I have a water filter company. And every day, hundreds of articles are appearing. Oh, this place now is struggling with water. Cities in the United States are struggling with water. You have the entire global climate change thing that was created to control water, so that the people on those bankers, you know, they control the oil, they control the nuclear industry, they control water now. And the reason they control it is because of UN and international climate accords that give direct control of the water to the governments, because, oh, we got to save the water. And it's, climate change is all about control of water, period. That's all it ever was. It's never been about removing carbon dioxide. So if you're a tree hugger out there jumping up and down climate change, understand that you're playing right into the hands of the world bankers. It's all about control of water. That's all it's ever been. And, the same people that push the use, the extremely high use of energy, are the same people telling you that you have to stop driving your SUV because you're polluting the world because of climate change. And you know what, boys and girls? For the 20 years or so that the climate change, climate global warming, or whatever they wanted to call it at the time, it has been around, not a single ounce. In fact, we use far more energy every year than we used the previous year. How can that be in a world that wants to stop climate change? And there's all of these amazing technologies you read about, like paving the Sahara Desert, which is one of my topics tonight to talk about, paving the Sahara Desert with solar panels and then pumping that electricity to Europe. So what you're doing is you're taking all the heat of the Sahara Desert, all of the sunlight that comes in, taking 20% of that and pumping it up to Europe. And you're talking about climate change and reducing heat input. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. These people are so retarded. Can you say retarded? Retarded people? I mean, I just can't believe it. Like last week, I talked about the guy that wants to put the companies, they want to put a big solar reflector up in space, turn it into microwaves, and beam it down to Earth. So you're taking this vast amount of energy that never would be in planet Earth, beaming it down to Earth to create energy and saying that that solves global warming. So you're robbing from Peter to pay Paul is what you're doing. And so, or nuclear energy. Now they're saying nuclear energy is the savior. And I just saw an article last week that nuclear power is the savior. Oh, my goodness. The head of the World Nuclear Energy Commission. And it just plays right into their pocket, General Electric, etc. What do they sell? Central Power Company power. And all of the money that's been spent on alternative energy and all the money that the good do-gooders in Congress want to put into alternative energy, none of it will work. And you're still going to be left with GE and Siemens being the rulers of the electrical world out there, providing electricity, because none of the technologies that are being offered out there work. There's one technology that does work. It's called my wing generator, but you will never hear about it. You'll never hear about it in public because it works. All you're going to hear about is these goofy things like a balloon that sticks up in the air and waves back and forth. It's not going to even power a local 7-Eleven store. It doesn't produce enough power to run your house if you had one in your backyard. In fact, I have a note in my notes here from my show to talk more about this idea of beaming of energy down from of a big reflector satellite up in outer space where you could make it miles and miles across. Huge. Solar reflector, and getting, no atmosphere to block it or whatever, and then beaming this down to planet Earth. Well, there's a few little problems with doing that, not to mention all the birds it'll kill. You think a three-blade wind turbine kills a lot of birds. Oh, my goodness. How about a microwave beam that's hundreds of feet wide being beamed down to Earth? And if it's smaller, then it's going to be much more intense. And also it's going to break the vertical electric field. This is the same problem with the space elevator. These people come up with these ideas, and this is the thing, and I keep saying it. I mean, this is like out of comic books from the 1930s ideas. And stupid, because nobody understands the vertical electric field. So if you build a space elevator, it's going to discharge the vertical electric field. If you build a big satellite system up in space and beam the energy down, you're going to be breaking down the vertical electric field from the ionosphere to the ground, and you're going to have a big catastrophic disaster at that point. And so anyway, that's the people doing this stuff. But are nuts. I mean, they're scientists that have no idea what they're doing. They're claiming that this is going to reduce global heating from fossil fuels, but it's going to increase heating from another source. I mean, I mean, what are these people smoking? Wow. I'm just incredibly amazed, beyond incredibly amazed at the ignorance, stupidity, and absolute retarded cultures out there in the scientific world. But anyway, as long as they, and this is the thing too, is these things get funded. They get funded. People rush to them and, oh, here's some money. But you know why they do that? Because it detracts from anybody getting any real solutions in place. Or let's talk about this one, a float out in the North Sea, floating and bobbing up and down to create energy. Or a propeller in the Hudson River. You put these things down in the Hudson River, and as the tides flow in and out, it creates energy. Well, you're going to power maybe a couple apartment buildings with that. You know, maybe, if you're lucky. But, and what are you going to do when the tide's in reverse? It's not producing any energy at all. So for a good 6 to 8 hours of the day, when the ebb and flow of the tide is minimal, you're not going to be producing any energy at all. So, you know, you're talking about what, just like solar. You have only a few hours of day when the energy is being produced. So it's not a solution. A solution is one that works consistently throughout the day. And that's why wind is the only solution. But that's why decades ago, GE and Siemens had to recognize, and they still have to recognize somewhere in their engineering staff, that, hey, these things don't work. The 95% of the wind just blows right through them. I mean, boys and girls, I talked to a guy, and this is the guy that's the head of the National Electrical, it's like the Alternative Energy Department of the Department of Energy in the United States. I had a conversation on the phone with this moron, and I was talking about something called the Betz limit. And he goes, oh, well, you don't know about the Betz limit. And I said, yeah, I know all about it. It doesn't work. It's not meant for wind energy. It's meant for non-compressible fluids. Air is a compressible fluid. It is not used in hydraulics for specifically that reason. The Betz limit only applies to systems with non-compressible fluids, and that would be like water. For example, a good example is like a hydro dam where the water comes down a pipe. It hits the impeller, which is it expanding, and the reason it expands is because as the water slows down, as you take the kinetic energy out of the water, the water slows down, so the flow rate slows down, so you have to expand the fan blades, basically, if you want to call them that. And then the water goes out a chute at a much lower velocity, and so the outgoing chute has to be much larger than the incoming chute of water coming down from the dam. That's a perfect example of where the Betz limit applies. So it's for an impeller system or an energy extraction system in a system that is a non-compressible fluid. Air is a compressible fluid. And so the Betz limit does not apply, but they keep using it. And so they have completely misunderstood the amount of energy that can be had from the wind. And so they think that their three-blade wind turbines are getting up to like some maybe 50% efficiency based on the concept of the Betz limit. And I've had wing generators operating at 7 to 8 times the Betz limit in because the Betz limit doesn't apply. And so on average, you could have 2 times the Betz limit on average with a wind system. And the top people at General Electric and Siemens and the top people in the government of the United States who are physicists don't know this. They don't understand it. Oh, my goodness. It's like NASA using rockets. Nobody in their right mind would use rockets to go into outer space unless you wanted the people to think that that was the way to go into space and you were just trying to fool them. That's the only reason you would do that. Okay, so anyway, This was an interesting show. My entire thing I wanted to talk about tonight was the Peruvians going up to mountaintops and having basically group activities where they have religious ceremonies. And this was my main science topic. And what I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about it, and I'll divert it to next week because I need an entire show to talk about this. But first of all, a little diversion here. A week ago or 2 weeks ago or something like that, I talked about the I was talking about the myth of Sisyphus. And I used this example when I pre-sold my prime number, Principles of Prime Number, Volume 1. I used this, and on my show a couple of weeks ago, I was using the Greek god Prometheus. Prometheus is the guy who stole fire, or took fire and handed it to the humans. And he was, of course, not in good favor for doing that because they didn't want, and it's just like, imagine if we lived in the old Greek gods days with mythology, etc., that whoever the god was that gave nuclear power to humans would be ostracized also. But in the ancient world, Prometheus gave fire to the humans, and that, of course, changed the course of the human race. But the guy who rolled the rock up the hill every day, the guy who was the king who went away, and when he died, he asked for an extra day at the gates of Hades and the afterworld, and he was returned as a favor, and who escaped and hid. And then when he finally died, the guy said, okay, you like to be the head of Hades, said, okay, you like to be human so much, I'm going to let you be human forever, but you're going to have to do this. And you roll up this rock up the side of this mountain, and when it gets up to the top at the end of the day, it's going to roll back down, and you get to do that tomorrow and the next day forever. And that was Sisyphus. And so anyway, I apologize. Live radio, sometimes those kind of things can happen, especially with, you know, and I'll tell you something. I have so many things going on today that, you know, I guess that making mistakes like that, I apologize for it, but at least I come back and correct it. But yeah, it was Sisyphus was the Greek, he was not a god, he was a human who was, and he's probably still doing that someplace today up in Mount Olympus, in back in the old Greek world, rolling this big rock up the hillside. And when it got up to the very top, at the end of the day, it would roll back down, and the next day he would get up and have to do this again. Great sweat and toil. And so anyway, that's what the gods did to him because he fooled them. He tricked the gods, and that's something you don't do. Ooh, you do not trick the gods. You trick the gods, and they will vengeance on you. Just like Chuck Schumer said to Trump, said, you mess with the intelligence agencies, they have 10 ways to Sunday to get back at you. And well, then that's what they do. Because they run the United States, the CIA top down. The CIA, by the way, boys and girls, is the police force of the World Bank. They're housed in Langley, Virginia, and a lot of other places around the world, and they're basically the police force of the World Bank. And so they, for example, when John Kennedy wanted to get rid of the CIA and get rid of their banking system, we all know what happened to him. And that was a message, too. It was not just getting rid of that guy. That was a message to all other politicians. And in behind him comes the biggest gaslighter of all time, Lyndon Johnson, and gives the, you know, just lays down the carpet for the CIA to run the whole country. Ronnie Reagan thought he was going to run the country. Ronnie Reagan thought he was president. Well, same deal. But Reagan was a little tougher. He didn't die. He took a bullet in the ribs or somewhere. And some people say it was in his neck. But anyway, he lived through it. But he certainly was not president anymore after that. And there again, sending a nice, clear message when they blew up Paul Wellstone in midair coming into a landing strip up in the Iron Range of Minnesota when he was going to vote no. He was going to be the only hangout on the Iraq War. Blew his plane out of the sky when John Kennedy Jr. was going to become president, clearly, and he was running against Hillary in the state of New York, like in the very beginnings, that would have ruined her political career forever, John Kennedy Jr. and his wife, who could have run also. That was the mistake they made with other people in the past, is they wanted to make sure that the whole family, including the wife, got killed, because in a lot of cases, the wife would have picked up the ball and ran with it, because she knew, because of being married to the guy, whoever it was. Who was the guy? He was a senator down in Missouri. A clear-cut case of that, where he died. Or Jaime, what was his name? The president of Ecuador, who was a young, vibrant leader of Ecuador 20 years ago, something like that, blew his family and him out of the sky in a jet. The CIA did it, and Ecuador finally came back and requested the CIA documents on that. They made them public, showing clearly that the CIA blew his plane out of the air, killed him and his whole family. But see, they got to kill the whole family, because out of that family can come somebody that's even more powerful. And they learned that the hard way when back in the days when they were controlling Argentina and Brazil and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so the topic I was going to talk about it, I'll just leave it till next week. I'll be talking about the Peruvian groups that go up to the very high peaks in the Andes to have their religious ceremonies, why they do it, how they do it, and what is it all about. It'll be dealing with the electric rivers to the stars topic. Very important. And so I'm just about out of time here. Just to remind you, I have on my webpage, the sales page, JMCC Water Filters. Use the coupon code JMCC for 10% off any purchases there. A lot of people are purchasing the home make-your-own water filter, where you get a beautiful stainless steel spigot and either 2 or 4 or 10 of my new HI just fabulous water filter elements, and at a very reasonable price to make your own gravity water filter. Then I have the stainless steel sink water filter, just an amazing product. And it comes with either 1 or 3 or extra or 9 extra, 10 total filter elements. Very nice pricing. I can't believe the low price on that product. And the MR5, the whole house water filter, something you all should get. For under $2,000, you can have a whole house water filter. It's plumber installed. You get your own plumber. We help that plumber install it, so it's worry-free. The installation goes flawless. And for under $2,000, you have your hot and cold water in your house filtered. And here's the deal. When you're in that daily shower, you're getting a total blast of toxins. It comes through your skin. You're breathing it in. And this stuff accumulates in your body over time, 5, 10, 20 years, and you start getting sick and you don't know why. So you got to get this stuff out of your water. It's everywhere. Anyway, take it easy. I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. Remember the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.